isotopic limit. Gravitational waves on D-rated plate.
Hey, thanks a lot. Yeah, I almost spent a weekend enjoyed it very much, and actually most of the stuff I'm going to be talking about is actually done in the office down there. So Liam and I were working hard trying to finish this, and I want to talk about is what we consider a rather model independent constraint or bound on the amount of gravitational waves produced during gravitation. And it's based on two simple ideas that are embarrassingly simple, and when you put them together, they actually lead to surprisingly strong constraints. But it's simple enough that I can actually present them in as much detail as we're trying to write them over right now. And then I'm trying to keep this very informal, and I hope actually to discuss with you, what do you think this actually applies for. For the status of observing gravitational waves in those kind of models. So, of course, these are exciting times to be talking about these kind of things, because we actually have experimental data that is better than we could have ever hoped for. I guess before I was born, people didn't even imagine that these things would be measured, but now they have been measured to extreme accuracy.
That's your data slide? That's the slide.
That's our
How does that fit?
What's the price for it?
Yeah, so WMAP 3 came out with something, if I was doing a PowerPoint, I would be showing you. Impressive images of how accurate the action measuring these temperature fluctuations. And it has really risen the bar for theories of inflation that try to explain these fluctuations. Whereas previously it was quite possible to write down all kinds of different structural formation theories. But this data is really very specific. Therefore leads us to think about the next step of actually, what really produced these fluctuations and what are the details, detailed properties of detailed statistics of those fluctuations. But it also raises the question what the actual physics of the question is, what is the quantum field and what is its potential. Because it turns out that actually the detailed features of these fluctuations depend on what kind of potential you assume here. And there's a somewhat frustrating situation that, if you're imaginative enough to write down a sufficiently complicated potential, then you can predict a great variety of possible observables. So the way to ask a constraint is actually thinking more from a particle physics point of view, from a fundamental point of view, and asking is that it's a hippocamp. And once you have identified a hippocamp candidate, you can actually make accurate and more detailed fluctuations than you can in effective field theory. So that's what I want to do. So this is my outline. What I want to do at the beginning of the talk is basically just go over basics of inflation, just to kind of set my notation and define the variables that I will be using. And after I've done that, it actually will be a very easy, quick step to derive what's an important bound on the amount of gravitational waves that inflation produces. And the relation to field variation during inflation. But once one has this bound, one can actually connect this bound to microphysics, because you can then ask yourself, what do microphysical theories tell you about the variation of the potential inflation candidate? And that directly feeds back into our gravitational wave signature that you can expect. So we're trying to do this for a specific scenario of warp gradient inflation string theory, and ask ourselves, what's the maximum field range that the inflaton can move in those type of scenarios? And so we're limiting the field variation microscopically, and by doing so, we're limiting the amount of gravitational waves. But a priori, of course, it's not clear how strong these limits are, so it actually just remains to be worked out to see what one gets. So these are the kind of bounds that I want to present right now. And then we're going to discuss the implications for slow rogue gradient inflation and for the UBI inflation. And basically open the floor for discussion. So are there any questions before I start? Okay. So I'm going to go over some bit without wanting to insult anybody. I'm going to go over some basics of inflation. And I almost is too simple to mention, but there are important ingredients to derive the light on. So I'm just going to go over this rather quickly. So, in particular, the background dynamics of the integral field. So the background is a field that only depends on a homogeneous field that only depends on the time coordinate, and it's determined. The evolution is determined by two equations. So the Friedmann equation. And then the time derivative of the Hubble constant. Yeah, where the Hubble constant is defined as time derivative of the log of escape factor. So if given those two equations, you know, and escape and a potential for the input constant, can calculate the evolution. And in particular, what one can also, what can also then derive is that the acceleration of the scale factor is given by a double dot over a, 1 minus epsilon, where epsilon is defined to be this first slow rho parameter. And in particular, using this second Friedmann equation, this actually becomes d phi over dn. Where dne is the differential of Hubble constant times the time differential. And then there's a second slow rho parameter, which is simply defined to be the time derivative of the first slow rho parameter divided by the first slow rho parameter. So these are not quite the conventional slow rho parameters. Epsilon is. But this eta is actually a combination of epsilon and eta that you're probably familiar with. So this is not Hubble's slow rho. But I think it's related to Hubble's slow rho by something like 2 epsilon minus eta Hubble. Just turns out that for our discussion, this would be a more convenient parameter. But in order to get inflation, both of these parameters have to be small. There's no difference in that condition. In particular, this one has to be less than 1 in order to get acceleration, just by definition. So that's the background dynamics. We also want to talk about fluctuations. And so to first order these low to row parameters, one gets Fourier formula for the scalar fluctuations. Let's say pi squared, epsilon squared, n squared over epsilon. And then importantly, one also gets tensor fluctuations, which is 2 over pi squared, 1 over pi squared, squared. Okay. And the most important quantity for the rest of the talk will be the tensor scalar ratio. Which is 16 epsilon. And whether this is 16 or 12.4 depends on what kind of scale you define this ratio. So that's just standard WMF convention. So you notice that the scalar tensor ratio is just measured by the first slow rho parameter. So if that is small, then the tensor scalar ratio will be small. And it's also important that to first order the slow rho, inflation predicts the scale dependence for these spectra, which somewhat unfortunately are defined like this. So ns minus 1 is the log of ps, d log of ps. D log k. So that's minus 2 epsilon minus my eta tilde. And the tensor spectral limit is defined equivalently. So that's just minus 2 epsilon. So combining these things will actually arrive at a consistency relation between the tensor tilde. Tensor tilde and the tensor scalar ratio, which is minus. So if one simultaneously were able to measure the tensor amplitude and the tensor tilde, one could check this single fields in a row consistency relation. Yeah? That is modified for both multiple fields and theories that aren't single row theories. That's what we discussed for the basic PDI. That's a good, you know, good test of single row consistency. One of the most prominent inflationary reflection of one. So WRAM is really starting to actually constrain these quantities, and importantly also they're now putting constraints on the NSR plane. So probably one of the most exciting figures in their recent analysis is this plot of R versus NS, where they have confidence contours. It looks something like this. And so the plane, according to inflationary models, then populate this plane, but they also divide up the plane into three specific regions. So there's a region of what's dubbed the hybrid models. Then there are large field models here. And small field models down here. And you can distinguish between red and blue spectra. So this region is somewhat unfortunately called hybrids because it's a very particular class of hybrid models with blue spectral tilt. Whereas really hybrid, you know, what we conventionally think about as hybrid models can really populate this whole thing. And the reason this is divided into large and small fields is exactly because of the life bond that I'm going to talk about. Yeah? So in order to produce a large gravitational wave signal, you need large excursions in inflationary field space. And we're going to derive in a second. And if you want to suppress gravitational waves, you only allow them in a very small distance to cube space. If you would be living in this time region. And the two simplest inflationary models live somewhere live here and here. So the x here is m squared pi squared. And here the dot would be lambda phi to the fourth. So lambda phi to the fourth is marginally ruled out to a sigma level, whereas m squared pi squared lies within the one sigma contour. But both of these will be classified as large field models with large amounts of tensors. So there's a promise of actually seeing this and ruling this out in very near future. Any questions on these basically just definitions?
Okay, the pi squared, m squared pi squared, you put it there, well, is because you are fine tuning the end. You are fine tuning the end to get a snow row. So
you have to fine tune, but it's fixed by the amplitude. So you have to fix the delta rho over rho of the Cauchy normalization.
Right.
So if you want to do that, you pick up the fixing of the scale.
Yes, but then the end is very.
M has to be small. So in particular, that M actually can calculate the standard theta parameter, which is n squared v double prime over v. Then that turns out to be m squared over Hubble constant squared. So typically, in order to get inflation, this has to be less than 1. So your mass scale has to be less than the Hubble constant during inflation. But that the Hubble constant during inflation is linked to the Cauchy normalization. I forgot the exact number, but typically this has to be greater than minus 5. So in 96, Lyoth wrote a 2 or 3 page paper advocating this very simple and nice idea that actually potentially connects microphysics and particle physics and the CMU polarization spectrum. And from what we have set up here, actually, it's just a matter of what left.
Before you start, before you leave this topic, so this is all very, the definitions of eta and eta twiddle are all very general. And the only restriction to simple field inflationary models is in the formulas for PS and P sub T, I guess, right?
These?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so one question, and this is just an ignorance question. So I know how those are going to drive for the slow roll single field inflation model. For DBI kind of models, is it this exactly the same expression that you use?
No. Actually, for DBI, I'm going to get to this, but
okay, well, I'll wait to get it.
Well, I can jump a little. They're very similar, in fact. Yeah. So the way this is, DBI can also be parameterized as a theory with a non-trivial speed of sound. So for slow roll, the speed of sound will be equal to 1. But DBI is almost less than 1. Yeah. So the way this enters here is modifying the consistency relation. So that as CS will enter here. And you will get another parameter here, and the parameter, slow roll parameter S, which is defined as CS dot over CS. So the logarithmic derivative of speed of sound with respect to the number of peoples. So in for slow roll, this is just zero, but this can be non-trivial for DBI. Right. In particular, it's actually not required to be less than 1 in order to get inflation. So it's required to be less than 1 in order to have scaling invariance in the observer regime. But once you exit the observer regime, you could actually allow this one to become large, which means large deviations from scaling invariance outside the observer window. And that's actually going to be interesting for us later on. So there's actually a way of unifying the description of. I just want to present slow roll first because everybody's looking at it. But I could have done the generalized speed of sound derivation to start with, and then just take speed of sound to 1 as a limit of slow roll.
Are you using those definitions in terms of page
and not potential places? Yeah. Because actually, so you can do the same thing in terms of potential slow roll parameters, but then the results you're getting is a slow roll results rather than exact results. What I'm actually deriving now from the life ball is an exact result, it's not even a slow roll result. And it follows immediately just looking at my definition of epsilon. So if I just rearrange that definition, I get that differential of phi over Planck is the square root of 2 epsilon dNe. Okay. Without having either a slow roll approximation or anything. But then I also know that the scalar ratio is given by 16 epsilon. So this is in fact the square root of r over 8 dNe. And if I define Ne to be 0 when the largest observable scale x is the rest, yeah, the quadrupole, and I define the end of inflation. 60, so I'm calling E for its forward, and positive. Then I can integrate this equation, and I get delta phi over Planck is the integral of the square root of the tensor to scalar ratio from 0 to the end of the equation. So that's how far the field is moving from when the largest scale exits the horizon to the end of the equation.
I mean, article 16 epsilon, you probably said this, but I didn't catch it. That's something which does change or does not change in the DBI?
That does change. That will get a speed of sound. So what doesn't change is the tensor, but R changes, and that's why the consistency relation changes. Yeah, that does change, and that's why. It's actually, that's why a priori, this relation of the right here does not have to hold for DBI. It happens to hold for DBI, but it doesn't hold for generalized speed of sound. As I'm referring to right in the moment. For generalized speed of sound theories, it doesn't hold. And there actually might be interesting ways of getting around those for the case. For just a general case, which is not DBI. For DBI, it turns out that actually after the dust settles in, what you end up with is exactly this. So the light one doesn't change, but it could have changed. Okay, so the question is how the tensor to scalar ratio changes during inflation? Because that then implies, and what the scale of it is, that defines, you know, how far in field space you would have to move. So in particular, if you graph R versus NE, and if I tick mark with 4, 10, and 60, so starting at 0 is the CMD quadrupole. And n equals 4 corresponds to the multiple mode of 100 in the CFB. that's the furthest somehow we can hope to measure demorphization. So this is kind of the observable window of CMB scales. And then if you were to include large scale structure information, that gains you another 6 equals. Where any of equals to 10 corresponds to like an alpha scale, so large scale structure, SDSS scales. And then this is the end of the equation. So we kind of know that the tensor scalar ratio isn't changing much in that observable window. So if I call that RCAB. And then if you're assuming small role, you're also constraining how it is allowed to change after that time period. So in small role, for example, it's not possible that tensor scalar ratio immediately drops to very low values after this window that we observe. So if we do observe high tensors, then also from this low rolling gradient of motion, we can actually derive how tensor to scalar ratios will change in the future. So in particular, one could find that it keeps growing towards the end of inflation, or it decreases, or in extreme cases, I could imagine getting something like this. And the way you constrain this is by looking at the time derivative of the log of the tensor to scalar ratio with respect to n, which actually by definition is just the difference between the tensor field and the scalar field. So in order for this to decrease, you want this right hand side to be negative. Okay? And if you use the consistency relation for the tensor field, you will be getting minus r over 8, and then minus nx minus 1. So this first term would always be negative, so that actually tends to decrease the density of scalar ratios as time evolves. This can be positive or negative depending on whether the initial spectrum is red or blue. But you can also estimate the magnitude of this and then also show that this, because all these quantities that ultimately will be proportional to slower parameters, so it's small. So you don't expect extreme effects, but you can, if you look at quantitative details, then that does matter.
So can you know that RCB is on individual RCB is constant?
Well, it's limited by this. Yeah. I'm not saying it's constant. I'm saying it changes by this relation. So if you just, for example, if you were to assume that the limit on R today is 0.3.
Yeah, we have enough observed correctly to say that the ratio is constant.
Yeah, in the slower one, that's correct. And it would leave features. It would be, if it were to change rapidly, it would leave features in the scalar power spectrum. So, although we haven't observed them, if you were to tell me you want to do something like this in the observable window, I'm sure that it's possible to rule that out. Basically, what I'm actually requiring is not really that R is constant in this window, but because this window is so small, it's only 4 equals. Yeah? It's just well approximated by constant, even if this is the true curve. Yeah? What I'm saying is, in this regime, R hasn't changed much because it hasn't had time. According to this, it hasn't had time to evolve very much because the window is small. So then, the simplest bound you could set on this variation is just to assume that the field variation always has to be greater or equal to RCMB over 8. Times the number of equals in the CMB window, which is 4. So that's the weakest possible bound you can set on this field variation. But what I'm trying to argue is that there's actually a way of strengthening and extending that bound if you try to test the lower models. Because if you try to test the lower models, then you're bound by this relation. So what you can then actually do is you can define some effective number of pi-poles.
Yeah.
So if you give me a concrete model, you can actually do this integral. If you were to do this integral, you get something which is just defined to be proportional to RC and B over A, so you take the square root. And then you have to find some effective number of pi-poles. If R were a constant over the whole range, then this effective number, of course, would be just 60 pi-poles. If R is strictly increasing, then this effective number would be greater than 60. And if it's decreasing, it's something less than 60. So the strength of the black bond that we're proposing is to use delta phi over M back just equals R same D over A. Times this effective number of pi-poles, which is model dependent plus support power. And in particular, one here then gets that RCMB is 8 over this. And all we're proposing to do later on is choosing a conservative and effective for several models, which lies between 30 and 60. Yeah. Or even bigger than 60, but we're limiting ourselves to the case where R isn't changing at all. If R was for some reason changing rapidly, because you have a very, your initial spectrum is very blue and has a very unusually large amplitude of variation, then by this relation, you can estimate how much we'd expect, how big of an effect that would have on the change of R over the total range, and basically you got all the rough limit on the effective, which is maybe if your logs are very exciting models, you can push this down to 20 for certainly not less than that. Okay, but what this immediately shows is that an observable potential contribution to the CMB corresponds to a fixed variation which is avoided in plant mass, or in the top four dimensional plant mass. So then the question is, if you have a fundamental theory at hand, does that fundamental theory allow you to travel in field space by an amount that is that large? And we certainly don't know the answer, but if you put for a specific example, you can certainly test. And when you do test that, you automatically bound the amount of gravitational waves that you have in space. So then what we set out to do is actually test this for a specific model. So one of the most popular classes of inflation models, which are what? Brain inflation models. And in particular, because there have been claims that these kind of models can produce and even saturate the observational bonds on gravitational waves. So from a microphysical point of view, it would be interesting to see what it actually takes to make this happen.
Sorry, man, I'm a little bit confused with this situation. So if we have less number of e-folding, if you come for the small number of e-folding, then we will have RC and B will be getting larger. Is that true?
Forgiven. If in that same range the amount you move in field space, because now you will be moving in field space over 30 pi-poles. Yeah. So what you're doing mentally is you're choosing this but keeping this fixed. That's true. If you keep this fixed, and now in 30 pi-poles you move the same distance that you're trying to move in 60 pi-poles, then it is true that you have a larger R. Yeah. So maybe either way is if you actually rewrite this, just in terms of delta phi over Planck. So what this just means is if you try to observe given tensor scalar ratio in the CMB, then that tensor scalar ratio, if it is constant, then you're moving a certain number of e-folds will correspond to a certain distance in field space that you have tracked. If you travel more defaults with that same given tensor discrimination, you will have to move with larger distance.
Number of useful things is related to the ratio, tensor to scalar ratio, because the scale of inflation sets the number of the required number of people.
I know, that's true. Yeah, so it is related here. So this upper bound here, whether this is 60 or 40, depends on, first of all, details of reheating, and also depends on the energy field. So that is true, you can change that. It only makes a big difference because the energy scale of inflation goes as a fourth root of the tensor scalar ratio. It only makes a big difference if you go very low in tensor scalar ratio. So you find that when you find the company that if you talk about TV scale inflation, that this number should be changing to 40 or 50. Yeah. But then I wouldn't be expected to see gravitational waves in the first place. So for high scale inflation, which is the one which would allow you to get observed gravitational waves, these numbers are about 60, sometimes even 65. So if you try to limit high scale inflation, this is the number to pick.
This is this the slide. This is in the original light speed.
Oh, this one is.
Okay.
Yeah, there's originally there wasn't so much interest to make this bound as strong as it can possibly make it. Okay. Because one didn't have one, so to actually test this with any accuracy. But here we don't really care about factors of 10. Because when I can actually compute that feed bridge or limit that feed bridge, so it's important to, you want to make this bond as strong as possible. And so writing it this way actually allows you to strengthen the bond by factor of 100 almost. And because rather than using, so in life notation, that would have corresponded to picking an n effective of 4. And but because n effective is squared, If I'm picking 60 instead of 4, I'm strengthening the bound by 60 over 4 squared, which is 25. So for slower ones, you kind of, and since for slower ones, you don't expect this number to be much less than 60. If you pick it to be 4, you're kind of using power from the bound. Okay, so Liam already talked about what brain information models and some of the challenges that they have in actually producing flat enough potential. What I want to focus on here is actually predictions that can be made independent of knowing the details of that potential. So as assuming that you can arrange inflation, we're trying to see what kind of bombs can be put on the field bridge that the potential moves. And so here you have two or three dimensional brains. A D3 brain and a happy D3 brain. And they're separated by some distance in the internal space. So I'm calling the internal space rho now because I've used R for the tensor scalar equation. So this brain is fixed at some IR scale. And then this brain is moving towards it, coming from some UV end. This setup has to be incorporated into a walk-forward configuration. Because one can actually show that in flat space, the potential between those two brains is flat enough to get the inflation. But the warping decreases the force between the two brains and therefore makes the potential flat enough. So if you just look at the configuration in the internal space, the D3 would be a point, and then the D3 is a point at the tip. This is the warp throat. And then there's a bulk attached to attached to the throat. And the idea is that the D3 is moving towards the anti-D3 at the tip. Because there's a Coulombic force between them. So then you can write the metric for this warp space, which is h to the minus half. And the six-dimensional coordinate is h to the half. So this is the metric for our four-dimensional extended space. This is the metric for the internal space. And this metric has a form of a cone, so the rho squared bs x bar, where this is the metric of the base of the cone. And usually this metric is chosen to be an isolated space in order to let the whole configuration here. And typical example for an isolated space would just, simplest example would just be S5. Clever of Strasser's work would be Q11. It's possible to just wind cubes. What I'm describing now is independent of the detail of the geometry. And in particular, you know, away from the UV and the IR region, that space is well approximated by AES5 cross S5. And the warp factor becomes R over rho to the fourth power, where capital R is the ADS scale, which is 4 pi G string and pi cubed over order of x5. So n is an integer number, it's the number of D3 background blocks. And log x5 is the volume of the base at the unit radius. The dimension is volume of the base at the unit radius. So that's important. So for S5, that volume would just be pi cubed. For T11, that volume would be 16 pi cubed over 27. And then in any case, your generic prediction for this would just be that it's pi cubed, or pi cubed. That's going to be important for the moment.
On the level of the front, but at the top.
So if I lost standard dimensional reduction of that metric, that's a 10D metric, you reduce it to 4 plus 6 dimensions, then you get a relation between the 4-dimensional backrest square and the warp volume of the 6-dimensional space divided by kappa 10 squared, where kappa 10 squared given in terms of G string and alpha. But what's important is the appearance of this six-dimensional warp volume. Okay. So that's defined as just the integral of the warp factor over the internal space. So what we can do is actually split this up into a contribution coming from the bulk and a contribution coming from the throat. And this one is hard to calculate because we don't have an explicit metric for the bulk. And it's also very model dependent, so we're to approximate this in some way. So what we try to do instead is do the most conservative thing we could think of. And just imagine that that this volume is in any case greater than the volume coming from the throat region. And this is the actual contribution that we can calculate. So And in particular, if you do this calculation for ADS, ADS 5, then you get that this is just a half times the volume of the base times r to the 4 times the UV color. And it actually turns out that the actual value of this UV scale isn't important. So it's usually close to the ADS scale. But for the quantity we want to calculate, which is the ratio of the field variation to the length mass, it turns out that it actually cancels out of any expression that we eventually care about. So in particular, so this is what we need in order to compare, set the scale for our field variation. So now if I'm identifying inflaton with the D3, then I know that the canonical inflaton field is defined as the T3 tension times the radial coordinate squared. And the radial coordinate is bounded by the size of the space. So then that tells me that delta rho is less than rho uv. Because the rho IR is actually smaller than rho uv. So in particular, if I now calculate delta phi over n Planck squared. And I put in this relation, and I put in this relation, and this one. And in addition, I use the definition of the ADS scale. Then I find a simple expression that delta phi over n Planck squared. It's always less than 4 times the value of the background charge. And actually, importantly, it actually turned out that the volume of the base cancels out. And this UV scale here cancels out. So this relation is crucial because this is the one that is actually going to give us a bound on the density scale ratio.
What's that here again?
So it's like the background 53 charge of 5 form flux. So it's just
it sends the
two particular integers that should be large. You believe the calculation should be large. Right.
In any case,
it should be large. Yeah, so in super Gaussian approximation, it should be large. So we're actually in the process of, you know, quantifying how large we think this signature should be. It's not quite good. Because n is also defined in terms of these flux formed by n and k. So in order to have warping, the ratio of n to k should be large. Because that's what appears in the exponential of the warping. Then the question is, could you have a small n instead of exponential warping? But also trust your supergravity approximation. The question, yeah, I mean, if you really wanted to do that, maybe you can construct something like that. But typically you would expect n to be large, and then you would expect the variation field space to be bounded by this dimension. And notice that here we really made the most conservative approximation possible. By basically ignoring the log volume. If you were to add a volume, that's certainly constraining the problem. Because it would add volume.
So you're saying the volume counts as
the volume of the base.
Okay. Yeah.
This cancels out because so the four volume is proportional to this square. Mm-hmm. Or phi square is also proportional to this. Yeah. So that cancels out. And then if you work through the factors here, you'll find that this cancels out. Because if you look at it, I mean, this is R4, and the ball x5 appears in the denominator.
Sorry, so can I just ask something dumb? I guess is all the radius of the measuring the size of the throat field?
Sorry?
So as n gets bigger, the kind of the throat gets bigger. Yeah. As n gets bigger, the kind of distance the field can move in field space gets smaller.
Yeah. So naively would have thought, you know, if I just make my throat long enough, then that gives me a four-field range, and I can move nowhere. But it's not the field range, of course, in four-dimensional time units. So what happens when, as you increase the field range, you're also increasing the internal volume. That rescales your four-dimensional Planck mass. Yeah. And it actually rescales it by more than what you gain by having more radial direction. Yeah. So it's curious that actually as you make the throat larger and larger, you actually have less available field space in four-dimensional Planck units. So what we actually force to happen, if you want to observe gravitational waves, is very small throats. Yeah.
Is it clear that 5D5 in that way will become visualized?
Yeah, so this you can check. That appears if you look at the PBI action, just portions of the T3. We expand that action, it's more velocities. And that relation equals the PBI where you don't do that expansion. But that's of course crucial, yeah? All these statements are dependent on the fact that you choose your canonical normalizer.
Isn't that why the volume counts? The volume factor is just change scale reaction, but not the equations of motion. What kind of cancel the physical ratio?
So the way you said it, the last part of it sounds like that makes sense. You motivated the throat as being that's the place where you get the best slow roll, but to get R as large as possible, you want to actually have, there should be a slow roll you can possibly have, because you want epsilon to be as big as possible.
Okay.
So then it kind of makes sense what you just said at the end, that you're, so the shitty slow rolls are the ones that are very, very, very small, hardly any warp fields at all.
True. That's true. Well, that's a nice way of saying it. Well, you don't want to be shitty. Not so shitty. So given that you have this microphysical bound knowledge, the flux number, the relationship between the flux quantum number and the variation in field space, you can directly translate that into a bound on tensors. So in particular, you get 32, or it's an effective square times 1 over n. And actually, a nice way of writing that is as RC and B divided by 0.01, and that's 1 over n 60 divided by n effective. So people are still debating what the absolute limit of detection is for gravitational waves, but probably the most realistic estimate would be that this 10 to the -2 is what you can realistically hope in the near future. The ultimate limit will be something like 10 to the -3, 10 to the -4. And then it won't even depend on how well you build your detectors, because this is just you won't be able to beat foregrounds and lensing confusions by that level. But Dobrynin was kind of surprised by the magnitude of the foregrounds. So what they actually know, they kind of reevaluated these ultimate plots and think that that near and midterm future really R has to be greater than or equal to 10 to the -2. Otherwise, we will have a very hard time of seeing it. So an observable signal, of course, should be larger than this. Then you can ask yourself, what do you have to choose for your flux numbers and for this ineffective to make this happen? So in order to get this larger, you have to choose this n to be very small. Yeah. So your limit, the ultimate limit will be that this is an integer and has to be greater than or equal to 1. But there are also limits going fact that we want to be living in a multi throat. So now, there's some uncertainty in whether you choose this ineffective, but the largest range that we can imagine is something between 30 and 60. And if I choose the upper end, I get 1 over n. If I choose the lower end, I get 4 over n. So what I would have to do in order to see gravity waves in these slow rock throw models is have an n which is less than 1 or 4.
Yeah. understand the usually in these for uniform models, this n is bounded by the number of uniform planes you have, right? Which has the uniform. Isn't that the same? This is the number of D3 brains you need along the default to cancel tadpoles and all that.
Well, there's lots of other space in the block where there could be. So there's some total tadpole that you need to cancel, but this could just be any part of it that one likes. It could range from no D3 brain charge to as much as you want, up to the total amount of that tadpole. But you can imagine other stuff in the block canceling. So there's no fundamental bound that this has to be against itself, unless, except the assumption that you want it to be worked.
So some part of the loop cancels that.
So for smaller ones, this is an extremely strong restriction. Yeah? And especially remembering that, you know, we're actually deriving this being very conservative about what we consider the volume of the total space. Yeah. And typically, you know, like if you look at current data, then you really fit at the upper end of this range of what you call it. So you would be favoring the lower end here, so you really have a strong statement about what you need to do in order to build these kind of models. So if you see a slower brain inflation model that does predict observable tenses, we would claim you have to show us that this model is built with a background D3 charge that is at least satisfies this model. Plus you would have to show that you can actually embed this in the quantification where the bulk volume is negligibly small compared to the floor volume. So that seems very challenging. So then the next thing, but you might say that you actually kind of expected that because these brain inflation models were always advertised as being small field models, yeah, and producing extremely low tenses, yeah, of a magnitude of 10 to the minus 10. So then in that sense, you know, this isn't really a surprise. But calling this small field is a little bit misleading because what you mean when you say that is you're looking at the uncorrected potential for the electron field. And it's true that is exponentially flat. And epsilon is very, very tiny, and r is very small. But if you include correction from the compactification, that usually introduces one on one corrections into epsilon and eta. So typically, and then you have to tune those corrections, make them small to actually get inflation in the first place. So the minimal tuned models, you would argue, are the ones with the largest possible eta and epsilon, the largest possible observational reliable ones. So basically that means that these minimally tuned models favor large gravitational wave signals. We say that microphysically that's not possible.
So right, but it's for large depend on what you mean by large.
In R, in yeah.
Because I mean they always give you R very small. The epsilon is always very small if you follow.
No, but if you add the correction terms.
Yeah, but you tune it to get eta to be small to get a 60 fold.
But the epsilon can still be large.
Epsilon is still much smaller than eta.
Usually, yes.
So in that sense,
I guess all we're always saying is that if you were to see gravitational waves, yeah, that would falsify these kind of models. Yeah. Well, it's not a very strong signal because for slower world wave, you would have expected that anyway, and maybe you want to make the tensor signal very small there, and you do that by tuning. Yeah? If you tune less, then you're boosting the gravitational wave signal, and you couldn't imagine that you can boost it so much that it actually reaches observable level. Yeah? We think that will be incompatible with compactification constraints, or with the size of the internal space, basically.
Somehow it's almost circular in the sense that you're saying that you have less of a tuning issue by having a big warp throat. And I'm motivated thinking about the warp throat carefully. And then the conclusion was that you want to have not a warp throat. You want to have gravitational waves. But somehow your bounds are specific to this particular class of models which were motivated by and not by being nice and slow.
Yeah.
So your statement isn't really. You know, the last thing you said was kind of stronger, in the sense you're saying that having a compactation which works if someone gives you something with a large R, then it's hard to see how it's going to work in a compactation. What you mean is in a dwarf compactation like this, but it's motivated by having a small epsilon.
Yeah. You said a dwarf Lieberman model, right?
Yeah.
If someone gives you a dwarf Lieberman model with a large sensor, that's going to be faster.
Right. But if you're having to kill things anyway, then, yeah, okay, well that's a clear thing.
Regardless of any,
if you
never introduce a notion of tuning, this kind of configuration can't have acceptable tensions.
Right.
So that's just like, we're coming in as a firm statement independent of the idea of tuning.
Right.
So, if you want to spend 10 or 15 more minutes, let me look at you. Because DBI, of course, is the model where you would more naturally expect a large gravitational wave signals. So it's interesting to look at constraints for those models also. So the action that you're looking at for DBI models, is this four-dimensional action. We have a curvature which depends on this general function on which depends on x and phi, and x is the kind of the electrokinetic term. Now this function is an arbitrary. Now this function p is an arbitrary function of that x. So in particular, if you want to connect this to slow roll models, then p of x and phi just be x minus. Potential. For DBI models, P of x and phi is in fact P f to the minus 1 and then square root of 1 minus 2 fx minus f to the minus 1 was a potential. Where this f here is the inverse of a rescaled log factor. So it's T3 times H. But this axiom is general and actually covers more than just DBI.
Yeah. Does it make sense that like, any other situation might as well DBI?
Well, then it depends whether microphysics makes sense. That's a question of debate. Yeah. But this is a general action that was introduced first, I guess, in the K inflation. Where you have non-canonical kinetic terms in your action, you ask yourself what kind of dynamics you get from this. But it's true that there's problems with those, high derivative terms.
Right, so this is the norm. What is the more general case where you can get higher derivative terms and that makes sense?
More general than DBI?
Right. DBI does it, and so for there may be both solutions of the also.
But DBI doesn't even necessarily do it. If the f inside the square root varies, because I think there's restrictions on the derivative of f.
Yeah, how far down?
Because if you calculate x dot dot in the equation motion, then I think it's true that x dot dot, if f had been a constant, gets driven to zero as you get to the relativistic limit. But if you have f varying as a position, then I think x dot dot depends on the derivative of f. So the condition that x dot dot be small compared to x dot squared is a statement of the derivative of f being small compared to something. I don't know what something is. But I think that there's a for arbitrary functions of f, it's not necessarily true that DBI is this.
So then, for instance, we know what f is in some work. We can check your conditions and stuff.
Right.
And otherwise, then what would you conclude? And then the DBI.
Well, then it starts to have the width of k essence. Then you don't know that there's control over the approximation.
Yeah, so that's actually something we want to understand better, because what I'm actually going to show you, what we find is that in order to create a large gravitational wave signal, you actually require to have large f dot terms. Because those large f dot terms is actually what allows tensor scalar ratios to decrease a lot. Quickly after observer scales have fixed in the horizon. So it would be interesting if you could limit those by imposing validity of the DBI action.
But I think the criterion would be that since you're keeping x, all powers of x compared to x dot, you're asking for x, something like x dot is smaller than some power of x, where the dimensions of fix the power.
Yeah.
I guess it must be x dot over x has to be small compared to the square root of x.
No, but you have to have the constraint on x and x.
No, but the constraint will come from the criterion that if you take the equation of motion from your x and thinking of it as being a functional of e, can you ask that the equation of motion be consistent with the action having neglected x dot dot compared to x dot, which are your orders? The criterion is that x, you want your solution to satisfy that x dot dot is much smaller than x to the 3/2 or something like that. And if you ask that of your solution, the solution will depend on the derivative of f, and it'll become a constraint on the derivative of f.
Ah. Okay, as humanoid, it's just a more effective thing.
Yeah, so if you have an explicit form of draft, then that should be something that's
really most explicit.
Now, it'll be interesting because actually, what people find is that predictions from these DBI models are very sensitive to what kind of world type they pick.
Yeah.
So the simplest models have just picked AES5 world type, that's good. And they're extremely strong constraints, as I'm going to show for these kind of models. So what then people were looking at is actually if you have DBI application closer to the tip where you're less sure what the warp factor is, and then the predictions you get depends on what kind of assumption you make for the warp factor. But if these were constrained, then it would be interesting.
Yeah, we should be able to also just set it up as a functional problem. If you just took p as an arbitrary function, and then you ask the question, when is x dot small compared to the function of x, and thought of it as a differential permission on p, you might be able to find what the most general function is that has that property. Mm-hmm. Even if you know at least one solution, then you might find this. That's the only solution.
Right. So why do you require that
x dot be missing? Because what they're doing when you write that Lagrangian down, if you thought of it as being a derivative expansion, normally you would have to include all possible derivatives in any order. They're keeping things like x dot, phi dot squared, phi dot fourth, all orders and powers of phi dot. They're throwing away all the things involved in order number that applies. So phi dot dot is completely neglected here. And so you need some sort of a self-consistency argument that says that the higher derivatives of phi are small compared to powers of phi dot. And the DBI with constant f works in the sense it's like a relativistic particle, that as you go more and more relativistic, so x dot gets driven to phi dot gets driven to 1, phi dot dot gets driven to 0 because you're being pushed towards a constant.
Okay, so there are a few more relations you can derive by just assuming a constant an arbitrary p, and then you can generalize those, or specialize those to DBF. So in particular, from the action, you can derive the energy density just as 2x, 2 comma x minus p. And then you can define the speed of sound squared to be just dp over the rho, p comma x over rho comma x. And in particular, then for dbi, you find that this is basically the argument of the square root, 1 minus 2 fx. And that's often also called the inverse of the warp factor square, and the Lorentz factor. So this is what they call the Lorentz factor, and another analogy with relativity. And this is the speed of sound. And then, so if you want to describe the equation in this context, you define the same epsilon and eta parameters that I defined earlier, and you define the third parameter s, which is d log cs over bme. So this is the parameter that would obtain the derivative of this function f. And in order to have scalar invariance in the observable window, all of these parameters have to be motionless. As I mentioned earlier, outside the observable windows, you can allow those to become larger than one. Not this one.
Do they all have to be small, or can you have, since normally there's two slow roll conditions, could you have two of these not be small but cancel the things you need for the
equation? Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. So what do you. If you wanted to do that.
would be pretty good. This is a logic possibility.
Yeah, so I can write down the expressions for the spectral indices. So ns minus 1 is think something like this. So it's the same as this sort of row. Of course, you can also cancel these two and get something which is probably scaling row. Yeah? But usually the argument is that ignoring these very sensitive kinds of cancellations, you expect that both of these are independent data, have to be much less than one in order to get
state. And it's a little bit also that if they weren't both small, then you would. The dynamics would keep the rule slow.
It's true. It's slow, this one has to be small to be accelerating. This one has to be small in order to get 60 inputs. That condition is still true for those two. And then you have this third one.
So then you just say phenomenologically, S has to be small to get NS minus 1.
Yeah. But this one doesn't change. The tensor still doesn't change. What does change is the tensor to scalar ratio, as I mentioned. You have this extra factor of the speed of sound. So in particular, if you now look at how the rate of change of the tensor to scalar ratio with respect to the number of e-folds, that is given by the change in epsilon plus the change in the speed of sound. So you could imagine a large change in the tensor scalar ratios outside the observer window coming from a large change in the speed of sound. If you design your warp factor to do that. Yeah, but it has to do that with the right sign, and it has to do that quick enough in order to decrease RF if possible. So what you try to do there is actually have observer gravitational waves in the observer window and then make them decrease fast after. Outside that window. So that when you compute the whole integral, that whole integral will be supported by a very small range of e-folds. So that your n effective now is smaller than what we were finding for several. So we haven't quantified that perfectly yet, but it seems hard, in those kind of circumstances, it seems hard to get something which has less than 20 effective e-folds. But certainly, because the volumes get squared in that number, just changing it by a little bit can weakens the bonds again. But then it seems to tell you that it's not impossible in those models to get gravitational waves. But if you do get gravitational waves, that is correlated with a large change in the speed of sound.
Yeah.
And because that change shows up here, it's also correlated with a change in the spectral index. So if you, for example, if you had very small scale cosmological probes that tested the tensor scalar ratio at a scalar spectral index, you won't be expecting a deviation from scalar grams to the blue side, an order one deviation. So the question is, do we have any probes that constrain these at very small scales?
You said they're evaluated just places, right? So the ns minus one is being evaluated from right and exit.
Yeah.
And then your constraint you were integrating over all of the equal n. So,
to be very accurate, you have to include running up the spectral index. So you also have a constraint on that. So you then know how that changes the first order.
So you can
include the information from that.
So if you make C kind of do something dramatic, 30 equal x after or right next to something, then that's kind of thing you need that thing could help you figure out.
30 is not soon enough.
Yeah,
that's
what 30
is. 30 is slave.
Yeah. So yeah, you want to do it pretty much immediately after.
Why is it here when it happens? Why does it happen? I can't remember what the integral was.
Okay. So it's the integral is over the square root of.
Right.
The square root of the tensor scalar ratio. So if you allow that to be relatively constant up to 30 e-folds after, then your n effective is already at least as large as this, and now you're cutting it off.
Oh, I see, because the integral thing is fine, right? Okay, right.
So most of the contribution will be coming from the first 30 e-folds, that's true.
You're
trying to estimate the support of that integral.
Yeah, I guess I can never make it negative, right? That's true.
Okay, but because the light form was exactly the same, our general expression for the for the constraint on the tensorless generation hasn't actually changed. What has changed is the possibility of making this effective number of e-folds that the integral supports smaller than our lower limit of 30. And so you can push it down maybe to 20 or 10. Yeah. But then you would also have to show me at the same time how the speed of sound has, you know, in your model, that the speed of sound has the feature that to make this happen. Yeah. So you'd have to show me that this term is large and negative, I guess. Yeah. So it's an easy check in your model, because this presumably can be calculated easily. So you just check if that has the feature of producing larger negative contribution outside the observer window. And then you have the hope of producing sufficient gravitational waves. But the strongest constraint on these DBI model comes when you try to combine gravitational waves and non-Gaussianity. And unfortunately, that can't, you know, to assess that can't be done in a model independent way. So all of this so far could have been, you know, was done without specifying the potential. So what I have to do if I want to compare non-Gaussianity and R simultaneously, I have to make some kind of assumption what what my potential is and what the warp factor is. So the simplest kind of model you could imagine is just this quadratic DBI model, where the potential is dominated by a mass term. And you can then show that the Hubble constant as a factor of the field just goes linear with a small quadratic correction coming from the kinetic terms. Mm-hmm. So this is actually exactly then it's approximately linear in the field. And that's important because that actually allows me to relate epsilon times gamma to twice n flag squared h prime over h squared. Just turns out that from the definition of the first law rho parameter, it's just the usual Hubble's law rho parameter divided by a gamma squared, which is 1 for the slow rho case. But since you now have this model where h is linear, you find that you have this relation, the size of the field, and gamma and epsilon. But from earlier, we already have a bound on this. That this has to be less than 4 over n. So we get a bound on this product of epsilon. So the only thing we then that is left to do is relate gamma to the observed non-Gaussianity. So in order to shortcut this a little bit, I'm just going to cite the result. So Chen and Kashu and Shu have to write that this F and N parameter, which quantifies the amount of non-Gaussianity, is approximately gamma squared over 3. And we also had that R was 16 epsilon over gamma. Yeah, so this last equation can be written as epsilon over gamma times gamma squared. So this will be something proportional to R times F and N.
What were the bounds on F and L? The bounds of F and L?
Yeah, so F and L itself has to be, the magnitude has to be less than 100, right? The two sigma bound of L. So in particular, looking at this other side, we find that this is this has to be greater than n over 4. Okay. Drops on like this point of 1. In particular, actually, if you do include those factors, what you find is that n is less than 3 over 8 r times f and l. And the observational bounds are that R has to be less than 0.3, FNL is less than 100. If you put them in here, you find that N should be less than about 10. So a combination of constraints on tensors and Lagrangian in this quadratic DBI model leads to a constraint, again, to a constraint on the background charge, which is now has to be less than 10. Which will also favor large tensor strength. So now to suppress non-Gaussian energy, we have to drive the tensors up. So in DBI, there's this correlation between the lower amount of non-Gaussian energy and the larger amount of tensors. But the problem is, you know, at the same time, you also want to satisfy the gentle rho over rho normalization. And it turns out that this normalization is proportional, you know, to an order one factor to the volume of the base divided by the magnitude of the background charge. But we also know that this should be of order 10 to the minus 10. So if you now imagine the simplest case where you know your base is just S5 or just pi cubed, then given this bound, you know, you would be expecting order 1 fluctuations in the density. So in particular, n should be less than, n should be greater than 10 to the 9 volume of x5. So you have an upper bound of n coming from tensors combined with Lagrangian energy, you have a lower bound of n coming from the Kolmogorov normalization. And these two can only be made consistent if the volume of x5 is less than 10 to the minus 9. So you require a base and unit radius that is orders of magnitude less than your naive expectation. Or the simplest examples where you're just using x5 and q1. Well, we've checked and actually got, you know, spaces with bases that are that small actually do exist. Yeah. So it is possible to construct something. So Lee and Dingbell.
What are your units there? Is that volume, is that small in string units, or like a
unit radius?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What
do you mean by
this dimension?
What do you mean by radius?
Well, it's proportional to the. What's the point up here? Well, this sets your scale, and this has dimensions.
But this is dimensionless. It's at unit radius, what do you mean by radius? If it's not a sphere, if it's a general angle.
No, effectively, if you construct a cone over this thing and ask for the volume of the slice of that cone that fixed the radius of this fits in the cone, that's what you pay your radius. It's not clear that it's necessarily a great geometric definition.
Okay.
The approximations aren't going bad having volume that small, you're saying. It's the, normally, you like to have big volumes for things, but you're saying that this particular volume isn't really a problem for any of the other approximations you're making, like the time expansion or other.
Yeah, because it gets multiplied by.
It's not really the volume, it's like 4/3 pi.
Yeah. Like if I have a. So S5 would just be the radius of S5.
Right.
Yeah, smaller. Yeah. Looks like that would be hard. So it's just the dimensions pre-factor basically in the physical volume.
There's no issue of principle that would forbid you considering volumes that small.
Well, that's a question, so that's something we were thinking about. Something I know a little about when I was told is that in the dual gauge theory, an object like of this corresponds to a conformal field theory with an extremely large central charge. but I don't know exactly if that is worrisome or not.
But if you compare that with the spin scale, isn't that worrisome than that?
It is deeply worrisome, but the reason that we can't exclude out of hand that possibility is that if you look at that expression over there, mm-hmm. then you see that the effective radius of the ADX is actually still large in string units. Mm-hmm. Our overall string is actually big, so it's even for small n. So the effective tuple coupling is actually large. So we're not positive that it's problematic. In the sort of baseline picture, it looks okay. Maybe one can show that such a very narrow cone is actually bad, but we can't show it yet. So this is one of the main.
But it's basically a strong constraint on anybody trying to construct these kind of models. The burden on the model builder is to show that something like this can be embedded into a reasonable compactification. We just don't want to say it's impossible. But if you could say that it's impossible, then there's an inconsistency between those two relations, and you don't. We can make a statement that for the sentence, has 5 or T11 cases, yeah, for K explorer, for example, where you know this volume is 16 pi cubed over 3 or 27. These two relations can't be satisfied simultaneously. So you will have to build a cone that is anisotropic, to a degree that we quantify here.
But this is all these constraints are only for the quadratic potential.
That's
model,
true.
Right?
That's true.
Okay,
yes,
so
exactly.
Presumably the other way to get out is use something else.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But how about the kind of, if in the picture of V3 and V3, you do get the effects for potential and the direction.
Yes,
the fast storage is like the.
That's the. You would have naively would have expected this to be a double term, but of course you can't find that somebody could write down something which makes sense that has a different type of dominant term potential. But I don't think one can argue that this isn't the simplest possibility. Trying to get this, and in particular, the way you imagine getting these corrections is from non-conductive corrections and corrections from a non-conductive volume stabilization, which is generically. Give you these large M-squared classical contributions. So one of the virtues of the DBI model was that those large M-squared classical contributions was exactly what was needed to drive the mechanism. So it would be kind of a shame to give up on that and say, I need a more tuned potential to make DBI happen, because the real virtue of it was that it's not tuned. You don't have to tune a particular potential to make it work. All the dynamics is coming from the kinetic part.
Right. So, but some is even worse than the slow world. So, what do you want that coefficient of phi squared to be small? Now you want it to be zero to a low versus.
Yeah. Well, I'm not exactly sure if you have m squared phi squared and something else, what happens to h of phi, for example? It's not clear that you have to make it zero. I guess good balance.
So you say you can have a potential where phi squared is the first order, then you have other powers.
Maybe.
And but then plane phi for the other powers to be relevant, then phi has to be exactly perpendicular. Probably.
Probably, yeah.
If we use a D5 brain, a rapid Haskell cycle if we use the position of some pro D5 brain rapid Haskell cycle as making compute, then you'll be able to get one more scale or one more dimensionless parameter going into the random side of your bomb. Considering you have you can introduce that you may be able to introduce the dependence on the value of the given arm. In the case of the T3 brain, since the of the T3 brain scale the same way as the conventional plan scale, so you do not see any given arm dependence in the bar.
Yeah.
But if you really change to say a 5 brain or something, mm-hmm. you make it able to make more flexible.
Right. You said also the mechanism of Kleberner from the same understanding that the file changes is
on
Kleberner and Cyber? Cyber, sorry.
So you're
saying that the supersymmetry rating is coming from some sort of deformation, this parametric deformation of the master Kleberner cyber?
Right, I guess so.
Yeah, and so in that case, I mean, still what we're doing here is kinematic, it's independent of what's causing the supersymmetry rating and the kind of causing the stabilization potential. We're just finding the length of the field range, and that's not changing. The potential is
so, because of all this is what I was talking about the beginning of your talk, you were doing constraints on the gravity waves, but this is just constraint on the BDI itself.
Yeah, this is kind of reverse logic. What we were doing earlier was deriving this bulk on the gravity waves in terms of this flux number n, and then arguing that if n is greater than 1, you know, what does this imply for the bound of gravitational wave? Because it's greater than 1, then we found the bound to be delta phi. The problem relation is delta phi over m times squared has to be less than 4 by n. Mm-hmm. So as I'm making n larger and larger, as it may or may not expect for large, large volume, you're decreasing the available field range. So you're decreasing the allowed amplitude of gravitational waves. Yeah. Here we're kind of reversing it and saying the observational limit on gravitational waves, what kind of limit does that imply on n? Mm-hmm. And is that limit, if you include all constraints, you know, there's a little give an allowed window, and what kind of microphysical constraints can impose on that allowed window. Yeah. But for the simplicity of the algorithm, it just turns out to be very challenging to actually. Yeah. Naively, it's, you know, it's the allowed window is closed off by that window, and all that's a magnitude almost. So you really have to construct these natural terms.
But for people who have been working on this DBI, that was quite dangerous and straightforward conclusion since the beginning.
Yeah, this is not very new. Yeah. The reformalization in terms of the volume of X5 is kind of new.
Why people were excited about DBI inflation? I would just cheating. Why don't you see that as all that's not very nice?
Well, one part of this was not difficult. The claim was n greater than 10 to the 9, and all X5 is set to about pi cubed, because people thought, let's use a reasonable model.
Right.
But then lacking this delta phi over n phi squared less than 4 over n computation, which is an easy enough computation, but lacking that, one doesn't get this back on the right.
That's correct.
So that's where we're at.
Right.
Okay. That's correct. Uh-huh. Really. But also the
Gaussianity wasn't on. Right. I mean, it also brought in the non-Gaussianity, right? That was a new feature.
What they didn't notice is this correlation between having large number Gaussian. So it was all lingering there, because they did notice that in order to suppress non-Gaussianity, you have to move close to Planckian distances in field space. They didn't know if you move close to Planckian distances, the light from zone tells you that, you know, leads to a large gravitational wave signal. So in order to suppress non-Gaussianity, you have to move far. But then that gives you large tensors. So actually, we find a nice way of writing this is actually this problem required right now. Because that kind of combines the things.
And every code in the box of the heavy phi is 10 to the 15, but I have to understand.
Yeah.
That's the rim, I guess.
So 10 to the 15 is 12.
You put a pi cube, then you get 10 to the 11.
No, it's a ratio. So what he's talking about is basically the touch coupling, which is the related to the ratio of n to the 1 for the x5. There are two ways of making that large. It's either making n large or making 1 x5 small. Yeah. What we're saying is that really the bound is on making mod x5 small, because n has to be small in order to allow you to have large field variation. Mm-hmm. It's in a sense just a real interpretation. What's important, but what haven't been noted before, was that one of the bounds are combined non-Gaussianity and gravitational waves just depends on n. Whereas the bound on the delta rho or normalization depends on the ratio of the two. So that kind of breaks the symmetry bill. Yeah. The previous expressions that I've seen all depended on the ratio, because there was an implicit assumption on what it's typing by cubic.
So where's that filter ever going on in the memory?
What?
Yeah, this is just what I said.
It follows when you go through definition of the, I mean, I can show you. Definition of that over row, that's it. It's just the Hubble constant squared over the speed of cell epsilon. Wait, this is gamma. So all of these things can be rearranged. Actually, so it's a little bit more complicated. What you actually find is that this is proportional from r to the fourth FNL squared and n times log x5 over n. It's just if you substitute gamma for CS, use h prime over h for epsilon. And there's another gamma in there. There's an h squared here. You do a rearrange that to get factors of gamma squared, factors of epsilon. And then just they combine with this. But then you have a bound on this factor. And that's why, I should be writing this as an inequality. Because you know this combination r to the fourth times f and l squared is actually less than something from observations. And actually, including the prefactor, this whole thing is very close to 1, but strictly greater than 1. So as observations get better, actually, this prefactor would grow. And you will have to be working with even smaller base volumes. And of course, this one will also, as observation, you can also already see how you can rule this out, maybe within years. Yeah. Because this is 10 already, and we might start arguing about whether 10 is, 10 is big enough to actually, be talking about the controllable setup. But even without that argument might be superfluous in a few years, because really, you just have to decrease this combination R and F and L by factor. So R will quickly decrease by some factor, F and L will also decrease. So for example, if you look at the Planck satellite, I think Planck proposes to measure R to 0.1 and F and L to 5. Okay? And that leaves you with an N that is fractional.
This is constrained under the DBI, but why is it that you don't get a similar constraint for the slow rule?
Because F and L in slow rule was proven to be much less than this. Proportional to a slow rule parameter. Some other thing I have to say about the way you showed it. F and L in slow rule models is always proportional to a slow rule parameter, so it's always less than 1. And there's no experiment sensitive enough to ever measure that. So you can't use non-Gaussian. It's just this non-trivial speed of sound feature of DBI that makes this happen. If you decrease the speed of sound, if you decrease the speed of fluctuations, you actually allow for the possibility of having much non-Gaussian.
So all the other formulas that C went to 1 went to the slow roll formula, but that means the Gaussian non-Gaussian one must have this breakdown.
Right? So when I was writing this, this actually comes from 1/3 1 over CS squared minus 1.
Right.
This is gamma squared. Since I'm trying to bound the gamma squared, which is large compared to 1, I was dropping the 1. Right? Yeah. It's true. If you take the limit of CS to 1 here, it goes to 0. Okay. And then what you would be observing is the correction, which is the 1 epsilon. Yeah.
So I think we ought to be more into discussion at some point. Was there any more you want to say for your talk?
No, that's. I have one discussion page with the same
Well, why don't we all thank you all for your presentation.